The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. This week, I will read the third and final part of Raise High the Roof Beam, Carpenters, the 10th short story published by J.D. Salinger in the New Yorker magazine. If you missed the first two parts of the story, they are available on our website, ncreadingservice.org. Look for the October 14th and October 21st, 2022 recordings in the podcast section under the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today, though, with a recap of parts one and two of Raise High the Roof Beam, Carpenters by J.D. Salinger. The writer tells us about going to his brother's wedding in New York City in 1942. He knew no one, and Seymour, his brother, never turned up. Finally, everyone headed for the reception anyway. The writer got into a car with some friends of the bride. The matron of honor was furious because Seymour had backed out at the last minute. She said he was a latent homosexual, according to hearsay. The writer reveals his identity and defends his brother, who is retiring, poetic, and a genius. All the children in the family were famous radio quiz kids. An elderly man in the car turns out to be deaf and dumb. They are held up by a parade and end up at the writer's apartment for a drink. The writer finds Seymour's diary, which tells about his great love for Muriel, his fiancée, and about her mother's concern about his mental health. And now we re-enter the story in the middle of the writer reading his brother Seymour's diary. The whole company is restricted to the post tonight. Stood in line for a full hour to get to use the phone in the rec room. Muriel sounded rather relieved that I couldn't get in tonight, which amuses and delights me. Another girl, if she genuinely wanted an evening free of her fiancé, would go through the motions of expressing her regret over the phone. M just said, "Oh," when I told her. How I worship her simplicity, her terrible honesty. How I rely on it. 3:30 a.m. I'm over in the orderly room. I couldn't sleep. I put my coat on over my pajamas and came over here. Al SPC is CQ. He's asleep on the floor. I can stay here if I answer the phone for him. What a night. Mrs. Fetter's analyst was there for dinner and grilled me off and on till about 11:30, occasionally with great skill, intelligence. Once or twice, I found myself pulling for him. Apparently, he's an old fan of Buddy's and mine. He seemed personally as well as professionally interested in why I'd been bounced off the show at 16. He'd actually heard the Lincoln broadcast, but he had the impression that I'd said over the air that the Gettysburg Address was bad for children. Not true, I told him. I'd said I thought it was a bad speech for children to have to memorize in school. He also had the impression I'd said it was a dishonest speech. I told him I'd said that 51,112 men were casualties at Gettysburg, and that if someone had to speak at the anniversary of the event, he should simply have come forward and shaken his fist at his audience and then walked off. That is, if the speaker was an absolutely honest man. He didn't disagree with me, but he seemed to feel that I have a perfection complex of some kind. Much talk from him, and quite intelligent, on the virtues of living the imperfect life, of accepting one's own and others' weaknesses. I agree with him, but only in theory. I'll champion indiscrimination till doomsday on the ground that it leads to health and a kind of very real, enviable happiness. Followed purely, it's the way of the Tao, and undoubtedly the highest way. But for a discriminating man to achieve this, it would mean that he would have to dispossess himself of poetry, go beyond poetry. That is, he couldn't possibly learn or drive himself to like bad poetry in the abstract, let alone equate it with good poetry. He would have to drop poetry altogether. I said it would be no easy thing to do. Dr. Sims said I was putting it too stringently, putting it, he said, as only a perfectionist would. Can I deny that? Evidently, Mrs. Fetter had nervously told him about Charlotte's 9 stitches. It was rash, I suppose, to have mentioned that old finished business to Muriel. She passes everything along to her mother while it's hot. I should object, no doubt, but I can't. M can only hear me when her mother is listening, too. Poor baby. But I had no intention of discussing Charlotte's stitches with Sims, not over just one drink. I more or less promised M at the station tonight that I'd go to the psychoanalyst one of these days. Sims told me that the man right here on the post is very good. Evidently, he and Mrs. Fetter had a tête-à-tête or two on the subject. Why doesn't this rankle me? It doesn't. It seems funny. It warms me for no good reason. Even stock mothers-in-law and the funny papers have always remotely appealed to me. Anyway, I can't see that I have anything to lose by seeing an analyst. If I do it in the army, it'll be free. M loves me, but she'll never feel really close to me, familiar with me, frivolous with me, till I'm slightly overhauled. If or when I do start going to an analyst, I hope to God he has the foresight to let a dermatologist sit in on consultation, a hand specialist. I have scars on my hands from touching certain people. Once in the park, when Franny was still in the carriage, I put my hand on the downy part of her head and left it there too long. Another time at Lowe's 72nd Street with Zoe during a spooky movie. He was about 6 or 7, and he went under the seat to avoid watching a scary scene. I put my hand on his head. Certain heads, certain colors and textures of human hair leave permanent marks on me. Other things, too. Charlotte once ran away from me outside the studio, and I grabbed her dress to stop her, to keep her near me. A yellow cotton dress I loved because it was too long for her. I still have a lemon-yellow mark on the palm of my right hand. Oh, God, if I'm anything by a clinical name, I'm a kind of paranoiac in reverse. I suspect people of plotting to make me happy. I remember closing the diary, actually slamming it shut after the word happy. I then sat for several minutes with the diary under one arm until I became conscious of a certain discomfort from having sat so long on the side of the bathtub. When I stood up, I found I was perspiring more profusely than I had all day, as though I had just got out of a tub rather than just been sitting on the side of one. I went over to the laundry hamper, raised the lid, and with an almost vicious wrist movement, literally threw Seymour's diary into some sheets and pillowcases that were on the bottom of the hamper. Then, for want of a better, more constructive idea, I went back and sat down on the side of the bathtub again. I stared for a minute or two at Boo Boo's message on the medicine cabinet mirror, and then I left the bathroom, closing the door excessively hard after me, as though sheer force might lock up the place forever after. My next stop was the kitchen. Fortunately, it led off the hall, and I could get there without having to go through the living room and face my guests. On arrival, and with the swinging door closed behind me, I took off my coat, my tunic, and dropped it across the enamel table. It seemed to require all my energy just to take off my coat, and I stood for some time in my T-shirt, just resting up, as it were, before taking on the Herculean task of mixing drinks. Then, abruptly, as though I were being invisibly policed through small apertures in the wall, I began to open cabinet and refrigerator doors, looking for Tom Collins' ingredients. They were all there, except for lemons instead of limes, and in a few minutes I had a somewhat sugary pitcherful of Collins's made. I took down 5 glasses and then looked around for a tray. It was just hard enough to find a tray, and it took me just long enough so that by the time I did find one, I was giving out small, audible whimpers as I opened and shut the cabinet doors. Just as I was starting out of the kitchen, with the pitcher and the glasses loaded on the tray, and with my coat back on, an imaginary light bulb was turned on over my head. The way it is in comic strips to show that a character has a sudden, very bright idea. I put down the tray on the floor. I went back over to the liquor shelf and took down a half-full fifth of scotch. I brought my glass over and poured myself out, somewhat accidentally, at least 4 fingers of scotch. I looked at the glass critically for a split second and then, like a tried-and-true leading man in a Western movie, drank it off in one deadpan toss. A little piece of business, I might well mention, that I record here with a rather distinct shudder. Granted that I was 23 and that I may have been doing only what any red-blooded 23-year-old simpleton would have done under similar circumstances. I don't mean anything quite so simple as that. I mean that I am not a drinker, as the expression goes. On an ounce of whiskey, as a rule, I either get violently sick or I start scanning the room for unbelievers. On 2 ounces, I've been known to pass out cold. This was, however, by way of an unparalleled understatement, no ordinary day, and I remember that as I picked up the tray again and started to leave the kitchen, I felt none of the usual, almost immediate, metamorphic changes. There seemed to be an unprecedented degree of heat being generated in the subject's stomach, but that was all. In the living room, as I brought in the loaded tray, there were no auspicious changes in the deportment of my guests, beyond the revitalizing fact that the bride's father's uncle had rejoined the group. He was ensconced in my dead Boston Bull's old chair. His tiny legs were crossed, his hair was combed, his gravy stain was as arresting as ever, and, lo and behold, his cigar was lighted. We greeted each other even more extravagantly than usual, as though these intermittent separations were suddenly too long and unnecessary for either of us to bear with. The lieutenant was still over at the bookshelves. He stood turning the pages of a book he'd taken out, apparently engrossed in it. I never did find out which book it was. Mrs. Silsburn, looking considerably pulled together, even refreshed with her pancake makeup, I thought, newly attended to, was seated on the couch now, in the corner of it, farthest away from the bride's father's uncle. She was leafing through a magazine. "Oh, how lovely," she said in a party voice as she sighted the tray I'd just put down on the coffee table. She smiled up at me convivially. "I've put very little gin in it," I lied, as I began to stir the pitcher. "It's so lovely and cool in here now," Mrs. Silsburn said. "May I ask you a question, incidentally?" With that, she put aside her magazine, got up, and crossed around the couch and over to the desk. She reached up and placed a fingertip on one of the photographs on the wall. "Who is this beautiful child?" she asked me. With the air conditioner now smoothly and steadily in operation, and having had time to apply fresh makeup, she was no longer the wilted, timorous child who had stood in the hot sun outside Schraff's 79th Street. She was addressing me now with all the brittle equipoise that had been at her disposal when I first jumped into the car outside the bride's grandmother's house, when she asked me if I was someone named Dickie Braganza. I left off stirring the pitcher of Collins's and went around and over to her. She had fixed a lacquered finger on the photograph of the 1929 cast of It's a Wise Child, and on one child in particular. 7 of us were sitting around a circular table, a microphone in front of each child. "That's the most beautiful child I've ever laid eyes on," Mrs. Silsburn said. "You know who she looks a teeny bit like, around the eyes and mouth?" At about that point, some of the scotch, roughly a finger of it, I'd say, was beginning to affect me, and I verily nearly answered Dicky Braganza, but a certain cautionary impulse still prevailed. I nodded and said the name of the motion picture actress whom the matron of honor, earlier in the afternoon, had mentioned in connection with 9 surgical stitches. Mrs. Silburn stared at me. "Was she on It's a Wise Child?" she asked. "Oh, for about 2 years, yes, God, yes. Under her own name, of course, Charlotte Mayhew." The lieutenant was now behind me, at my right, looking up at the photograph. At the drop of Charlotte's professional name, he had stepped over from the bookshelves to have a look. "I didn't know she was ever on the radio as a child," Mrs. Silburn said. "I didn't know that. Was she so brilliant as a child?"
"No, she was mostly just noisy, really. She sang as well then as she does now, though. And she was wonderful moral support. She usually arranged things so that she sat next to my brother, Seymour, at the broadcasting table, and whenever he said anything on the show that delighted her, she used to step on his foot. It was like a hand squeeze, only she used her foot." As I deliver this little homily, I have my hands on the top rung of the straight chair at the desk. They suddenly slipped off, rather in the way one's elbow can abruptly lose its footing on the surface of a table or a bar counter. I lost and regained my balance almost simultaneously, though, and neither Mrs. Silburn nor the lieutenant seemed to notice it. I folded my arms. On certain nights, when he was in especially good form, Seymour used to come home with a slight limp. Well, that's really true. Charlotte didn't just step on his foot, she tramped on it. He didn't care. He loved people who stepped on his feet. He loved noisy girls.
"Well, isn't that interesting?" Mrs. Silburn said. "I certainly never knew she was ever on the radio or anything."
"Well, Seymour got her on, actually," I said. "She was the daughter of an osteopath who lived in our building on Riverside Drive."
I replaced my hands on the rung of the straight chair and leaned my weight forward on it, partly for support, partly in the style of an old back fence reminiscer. The sound of my own voice was now singularly pleasing to me. "We were playing stoop ball. Are either of you at all interested in this?"
"Yes," said Mrs. Silburn. "We were playing stoop ball on the side of the building one afternoon after school, Seymour and I, and somebody who turned out to be Charlotte started dropping marbles on us from the 12th story. That's how we met. We got her on the program that same week. We didn't even know she could sing. We just wanted her because she had such a beautiful New Yorkese accent. She had a Dickman Street accent."
Mrs. Silburn laughed, the kind of tinkling laugh that is, of course, death to the sensitive anecdotist, cold, sober, or otherwise. She had evidently been waiting for me to finish so that she could make a single-minded appeal to the lieutenant.
"Who does she look like to you?" she said to him importunately. "Around the eyes and mouth especially. Who does she remind you of?"
The lieutenant looked at her, then at the photograph. "You mean the way she is in this picture as a kid?" he said. "Or now, the way she is in the movies? Which do you mean?"
"Both, really, I think. But especially right here in this picture."
The lieutenant scrutinized the photograph, rather severely, I thought, as though he by no means approved of the way Mrs. Silburn, who after all was a civilian as well as a woman, had asked him to examine it. "Muriel," he said shortly, "looks like Muriel in this picture, the hair and all."
"But exactly," said Mrs. Silburn. She turned to me. "But exactly," she repeated. "Have you ever met Muriel? I mean, have you ever seen her when she's had her hair tied in a lovely big?"
"I've never seen Muriel at all until today," I said.
"Well, all right, just take my word."
Mrs. Silburn tapped the photograph impressively with her index finger.
"This child could double for Muriel at that age, but to a T."
The whiskey was steadily edging up on me, and I couldn't quite take in this information whole, let alone consider its many possible ramifications. I walked back over,
just a trifle straight-linishly, I think, to the coffee table and resumed stirring the pitcher of Collins's. The bride's father tried to get my attention as I came back into his vicinity to greet me on my reappearance, but I was just abstracted enough by the alleged fact of Muriel's resemblance to Charlotte not to respond to him. I was also feeling just a trifle dizzy. I had a strong impulse, which I didn't indulge, to stir the pitcher from a seated position on the floor. A minute or two later, as I was just starting to pour out the drinks, Mrs. Silsburn had a question for me. It all but sang its way across the room to me, so melodiously was it pitched.
"Would it be very awful if I ask about that accident Mrs. Berwick happened to mention before? I mean, those 9 stitches she spoke of. Did your brother accidentally push her or something like that, I mean?"
I put down the pitcher, which seemed extraordinarily heavy and unwieldy, and looked over at her. Oddly, despite the mild dizziness I was feeling, distant images hadn't begun to blur in the least. If anything, Mrs. Silsburn was, as a focal point across the room, seemed rather obtrusively distinct.
"Who's Mrs. Berwick?" I said.
"My wife," the lieutenant answered a trifle shortly. He was looking over at me, too, if only as a committee of one to investigate what was taking me so long with the drinks.
"Oh, certainly she is," I said.
"Was it an accident?" Mrs. Silsburn pressed. "He didn't mean to do it, did he?"
"Oh, God, Mrs. Silsburn."
"I beg your pardon," she said coldly.
"I'm sorry. Don't pay any attention to me. I'm getting a little tight. I poured myself a great drink in the kitchen about 5 minutes." I broke off and turned abruptly around. I just heard a familiar heavy tread in the uncarpeted hall. It was coming toward us, at us, at a great rate, and in an instant, the matron of honor jounced into the room. She had eyes for no one.
"I finally got them," she said. Her voice sounded strangely leveled off, stripped of even the ghost of italics. "After about an hour."
Her face looked tense and overheated to the bursting point.
"Is that cold?" she said, and came without stopping and unanswered over to the coffee table.
She picked up the one glass I'd half filled a minute or so before and drank it off in one greedy tilt.
"That's the hottest room I've ever been in my entire life," she said, rather impersonally, and set down her empty glass.
She picked up the pitcher and filled the glass halfway, with much clinking and plopping of ice cubes. Mrs. Silsburn was already well in the vicinity of the coffee table.
"What'd they say?" she asked impatiently. "Did you speak to Rhea?"
The matron of honor drank first.
"I spoke to everybody," she said, putting down her glass, and with a grim, but for her peculiarly undramatic emphasis on everybody.
She looked first at Mrs. Silsburn, then at me, then at the lieutenant.
"You can all relax," she said. "Everything's just fine and dandy."
"What do you mean? What happened?"
Mrs. Silsburn said sharply.
"Just what I said. The groom's no longer indisposed by happiness."
A familiar style of inflection was back in the matron of honor's voice.
"How come? Who'd you talk to?" the lieutenant said to her. "Did you talk to Mrs. Fetter?"
"I said I talked to everybody, everybody but the blushing bride. She and the groom have eloped."
She turned to me. "How much sugar did you put in this anyway?" she asked irritably.
"It tastes like absolute..."
"Eloped?"
said Mrs. Silsburn, and put her hand to her throat. The matron of honor looked at her.
"All right, just relax now," she advised. "You'll live longer."
Mrs. Silsburn sat down inertly on the couch, right beside me, as a matter of fact. I was staring up at the matron of honor, and I'm sure Mrs. Silsburn immediately followed suit.
"Apparently he was at the apartment when they got back," So Muriel just ups and packs her bag, and off the two of them go, just like that.
The matron of honor shrugged her shoulders elaborately. She picked up her glass again and finished her drink.
Anyway, we're all invited to the reception, or whatever you call it when the bride and groom have already left. From what I gather, there's a whole mob of people over there already. Everybody sounded so gay on the phone.
You said you talked to Mrs. Fetter? What'd she say? The lieutenant said. The matron of honor shook her head rather cryptically.
She was wonderful. My God, what a woman. She sounded absolutely normal. From what I gather, I mean from what she said, this Seymour's promised to start going to an analyst and get himself straightened out.
She shrugged her shoulders again.
Who knows? Maybe everything's going to be hunky-dory. I'm too pooped to think anymore.
She looked at her husband.
Let's go. Where's your little hat?
The next thing I knew, the matron of honor, the lieutenant, and Mrs. Silsburn were all filing toward the front door, with me as their host following behind them. I was weaving now, very obviously, but since no one turned around, I think my condition went unnoticed. I heard Mrs. Silsburn say to the matron of honor,
"Are you going to stop by there, or what?"
"I don't know," came the reply. "If we do, it'll be just for a minute."
The lieutenant rang the elevator bell, and the three stood leadenly watching the indicator dial. No one seemed to have any further use for speech. I stood in the doorway of the apartment, a few feet away, dimly looking on. When the elevator door opened, I said goodbye aloud, and their three heads turned in unison toward me.
"Oh, goodbye," they called over, and I heard the matron of honor shout, "Thanks for the drink,"
as the elevator door closed behind them. I went back into the apartment, very unsteadily, trying to unbutton my tunic as I wandered along, or to yank it open. My return to the living room was unreservedly hailed by my one remaining guest, whom I'd forgotten. He raised a well-filled glass at me as I came into the room. In fact, he literally waved it at me, wagging his head up and down and grinning, as though the supreme jubilant moment we had both been long awaiting had finally arrived. I found I couldn't quite match grins with him at this particular reunion. I remember patting him on the shoulder, though. Then I went over and sat down heavily on the couch directly opposite him and finished yanking open my coat.
"Don't you have a home to go to?" I asked him. "Who looks after you? The pigeons in the park?"
In response to these provocative questions, my guest toasted me with increased gusto, wielding his Tom Collins at me as though it were a beer stein. I closed my eyes and lay back on the couch, putting my feet up and stretching out flat. But this made the room spin. I sat up and swung my feet around to the floor, doing it so suddenly and with such poor coordination that I had to put my hand on the coffee table to keep my balance. I sat slumped forward for a minute or two, with my eyes closed. Then, without having to get up, I reached for the Tom Collins pitcher and poured myself a drink, spilling any amount of liquid and ice cubes onto the table and floor. I sat with the filled glass in my hands for some more minutes without drinking, and then I put it down in a shallow puddle on the coffee table.
"Would you like to know how Charlotte got those 9 stitches?
I asked suddenly in a tone of voice that sounded perfectly normal to me.
"We were up at the lake. Seymour had written to Charlotte, inviting her to come up and visit us, and her mother finally let her. What happened was, she sat down in the middle of our driveway one morning to pet Boo Boo's cat, and Seymour threw a stone at her. He was 12. That's all there was to it. He threw it at her because she looked so beautiful sitting there in the middle of the driveway with Boo Boo's cat. Everybody knew that, for God's sake. Me, Charlotte, Boo Boo, Waker, Walt, the whole family. I stared at the pewter ashtray on the coffee table. Charlotte never said a word to him about it, not a word. I looked up at my guest, rather expecting him to dispute me, to call me a liar. I am a liar, of course. Charlotte never did understand why Seymour threw that stone at her.
My guest didn't dispute me, though. The contrary, he grinned at me encouragingly as though anything further I had to say on the subject could go down only as the absolute truth with him. I got up, though, and left the room. I remember considering, halfway across the room, going back and picking up two ice cubes that were on the floor, but it seemed too arduous an undertaking, and I continued along to the hall. As I passed the kitchen door, I took off my tunic, peeled it off, and dropped it on the floor. It seemed, at the time, like the place where I always left my coat. In the bathroom, I stood for several minutes over the laundry hamper, debating whether I should or shouldn't take out Seymour's diary and look at it again. I don't remember any more what arguments I advanced on the subject, either pro or con, but I did finally open the hamper and pick out the diary. I sat down with it on the side of the bathtub again and rifled the pages till I came to the very last entry Seymour had made. One of the men just called the flight line again. If the ceiling keeps lifting, apparently we can get off before morning. Oppenheim says not to hold our breaths. I phoned Muriel to tell her. It was very strange. She answered the phone and kept saying, "Hello." My voice wouldn't work. She very nearly hung up. If only I could calm down a little. Oppenheim is going to hit the sack until the flight line calls us back. I should, too, but I'm too keyed up. I really called to ask her, to beg her for the last time to just go off alone with me and get married. I'm too keyed up to be with people. I feel as though I'm about to be born. Sacred, sacred day. The connection was so bad, and I couldn't talk at all during most of the call. How terrible it is when you say, "I love you," and the person at the other end shouts back, "What?" I've been reading a miscellany of Vedanta all day. Marriage partners are to serve each other, elevate, help, teach, strengthen each other, but above all, serve. Raise their children honorably, lovingly, and with detachment. A child is a guest in the house to be loved and respected, never possessed, since he belongs to God. How wonderful, how sane, how beautifully difficult, and therefore true. The joy of responsibility for the first time in my life. Oppenheim is already in the sack. I should be too, but I can't. Someone must sit up with the happy man. I read the entry through just once and then closed the diary and brought it back to the bedroom with me. I dropped it into Seymour's canvas bag on the window seat. Then I fell, more or less deliberately, on the nearer of the two beds. I was asleep, or possibly out cold, before I landed, or so it seemed. When I awakened, about an hour and a half later, I had a splitting headache and a parched mouth. The room was all but dark. I remember sitting for rather a long time on the edge of the bed. Then, in the cause of a great thirst, I got up and gravitated slowly toward the living room, hoping there were still some cold and wet remnants in the pitcher on the coffee table. My last guest had evidently let himself out of the apartment. Only his empty glass and his cigar end in the pewter ashtray indicated that he had ever existed. I still rather think his cigar end should have been forwarded on to Seymour, the usual run of wedding gifts being what it is. Just the cigar, in a small, nice box, possibly with a blank sheet of paper enclosed by way of explanation. And now, from the October 24th, 2022 issue of the New Yorker magazine, the American Chronicles section, "What We've Lost Playing the Lottery. The games are a bonanza for the companies that states hire to administer them. But what about the rest of us?" by Catherine Schultz. At my local convenience store, and almost surely at yours too, it is possible to buy upward of 50 different kinds of scratch-off lottery tickets. To do so, you must be at least 18 years old, even though the tickets look like the decor for a kindergarten classroom.
The dominant themes are primary colors, dollar signs, and shiny, as in gold bars, shooting stars, glinting horseshoes, and stacks of silver coins. When you are looking at a solid wall of them, they also resemble, based on the palette, font choices, and general flashy hecticness, the mid-90s internet. Some of them are named for other games, such as the Monopoly X5, the Double Blackjack, and the Family Feud, but most are straightforward about the point of buying them. Show me $10,000, $100,000, lucky, money, explosion, cash is king, blazing hot cash, big cash, riches. If your taste turns toward fast cash or red ball cash doubler, you can buy one for just a buck. If you prefer VIP club or $2 million gold rush, a single ticket will set you back $30. All this is before you get to the pick three, pick four, Powerball, and Mega Millions tickets, which are comparatively staid in appearance. They look like Scranton sheets and are printed out at the time of purchase. The strangest of the many strange things about these tickets is that, unlike other convenience store staples, they are brought to you by your state government. Only Alabama, Alaska, Hawaii, Nevada, and Utah are not in the business of selling lottery tickets. Everywhere else, blazing hot cash and its ilk are, like state parks and driver's licenses, a government service. How this came to be is the subject of an excellent new book, For a Dollar and a Dream, State Lotteries in Modern America, by the historian Jonathan D. Cohen. At the heart of Cohen's book is a peculiar contradiction. On the one hand, the lottery is vastly less profitable than its proponents make it out to be, a deception that has come at the expense of public coffers and public services. On the other hand, it is so popular that it is both extremely lucrative for the private companies that make and sell tickets and financially crippling for its most dedicated players. One in two American adults buys a lottery ticket at least once a year. One in four buys one at least once a month. And the most avid players buy them at rates that might shock you. At my local store, some customers snap up entire rolls at a minimum, $300 worth of tickets, and others show up in the morning, play until they win something, then come back in the evening and do it again. All of this, repeated every day at grocery stores and liquor stores and mini marts across the country, renders the lottery a $91 billion business. Americans spend more on lottery tickets every year than on cigarettes, coffee, or smartphones, Cohen writes, and they spend more on lottery tickets annually than on video streaming services, concert tickets, books, and movie tickets combined. As those two sets of comparisons suggest, lottery tickets can seem like either a benign form of entertainment or a dangerous addiction. The question that lurks within For a Dollar and a Dream is which category they really belong to, and, accordingly, whether governments charged with promoting the general welfare should be in the business of producing them, publicizing them, and profiting from them. Lotteries are an ancient pastime. They were common in the Roman Empire. Nero was a fan of them. Make of that what you will, and are attested to throughout the Bible, where the casting of lots is used for everything from selecting the next king of Israel to choosing who will get to keep Jesus' garments after the crucifixion. The lottery did not so much spread to America from England as help spread England into America. The European settlement of the continent was financed partially through lotteries. They then became common in the colonies themselves, despite strong Protestant prescriptions against gambling. In the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which held its first authorized lottery in 1745, dice and playing cards were forbidden, even in private homes. That contradiction can be explained in part by exigency. Whatever its moral bent, early America was short on revenue and long on the need for public works. Over time, it also became, as Cohen notes, defined politically by its aversion to taxation. That made the lottery an appealing alternative for raising money, which was used for funding everything from civil defense to the construction of churches, Harvard, Yale, and Princeton were all financed partly by lotteries, and the Continental Congress attempted to use one to help pay for the Revolutionary War. Lotteries formed a rare point of agreement between Thomas Jefferson, who regarded them as not much riskier than farming, and Alexander Hamilton, who grasped what would turn out to be their essence, that everyone would prefer a small chance of winning a great deal to a great chance of winning little. This initial era of the American lottery was brought to an end by the widespread concern about mismanagement and malfeasance. Between 1833 and 1880, every state but one banned the practice, leaving only the infamously corrupt Louisiana State Lottery Company in operation. Despite its name, the LSLC effectively operated across the country, sending advertisements and selling tickets by mail. So powerful was it that, as Cohen explains, it took the federal government to kill it off. In 1890, Congress passed a law prohibiting the interstate promotion or sale of lottery tickets, thereby devastating the Louisiana game and, for the time being, putting a stop to state lotteries in America. Predictably, in the absence of legal lotteries, illegal ones flourished. Above all, numbers games, which awarded daily prizes for correctly guessing a three-digit number. By the 1950s, increasing concern about the power and reach of the mob culminated in a Senate investigation, the Kefauver Committee, which judged profits from gambling to be the primary financial engine of crime syndicates in America. This declaration and the torrent of news coverage it generated had a paradoxical effect. It made lottery games seem so lucrative that, after decades of dismissing them as inappropriate for the honorable business of public service, state governments once again began to consider getting in on the take. It is at this point that Cohen's narrative really gets going. Although he nods to the early history of the lottery, he focuses chiefly on its modern incarnation. This started, he argues, when growing awareness about all the money to be made in the gambling business collided with a crisis in state funding. In the 1960s, under the burden of a swelling population, rising inflation, and the cost of the Vietnam War, America's prosperity began to wane. For many states, especially those that provided a generous social safety net, balancing the budget became increasingly difficult without either raising taxes or cutting services. The difficulty was that both options were extremely unpopular with voters. For politicians confronting this problem, the lottery appeared to be a perfect solution, a way to maintain existing services without hiking taxes, and therefore without getting punished at the polls. For them, Cohen writes, lotteries were essentially budgetary miracles, the chance for states to make revenue appear seemingly out of thin air. For instance, in New Jersey, which had no sales tax, no income tax, and no appetite for instituting either one, legislatures claimed that a lottery would bring in hundreds of millions of dollars, thereby relieving them of the need to ever again contemplate the unpleasant subject of taxation. Lottery opponents, however, questioned both the ethics of funding public services through gambling and the amount of money that states really stood to gain. Such critics hail from both sides of the political aisle and all walks of life, but the most vociferous of them all were devout Protestants who regarded government-sanctioned lotteries as morally unconscionable. However valid these concerns might have been, they were largely ignored. In 1964, New Hampshire, famously tax-averse, approved the first state-run lottery of the modern era. 13 states followed in as many years, all of them in the Northeast and the Rust Belt. In the meantime, as Cohen recounts, the nation's late 20th century tax revolt intensified. As Cohen relates in perhaps the most fascinating chapter of his book, those pro-lottery forces had a powerful ally in Scientific Games, Inc., a lottery ticket manufacturer that first made a name for itself by pioneering scratch-off tickets. In addition to delivering instant results, these tickets, like IKEA furniture, offer the appeal of active participation, which gives players the illusion of exercising some control over the outcome. Scratch-Off Tickets debuted to great success in Massachusetts in 1974. By 1976, every state lottery had jumped on the bandwagon. But that triumph presented a problem for Scientific Games, since it meant that the available market was saturated. To keep expanding its business, the company set about persuading more states to legalize the lottery. Starting in the late 70s, SGI began hiring lobbyists, contracting with advertising firms, creating AstroTurf citizens groups, and spending millions of dollars to persuade voters in Arizona, California, Colorado, Iowa, Missouri, Oregon, and the District of Columbia to pass lottery initiatives. Wins like that soon turned Scientific Games into an unstoppable force within the lottery industry. By 1982, the company had printed its 5 billionth ticket and was producing 1 million more every hour. At the same time, the lottery industry itself had become unstoppable thanks to the introduction of a new version of a very old game of chance that, as Cohen writes, fundamentally reshaped the place of lotteries in American society. Based on a betting game originally played in 17th century Genoa, Lotto is not self-evidently groundbreaking, or, for that matter, self-evidently appealing. To play, you guess a certain quantity of numbers from a specified range. The New York Lotto, for instance, requires 6 numbers between 1 and 59. The North Carolina Lotto, 5 numbers between 1 and 43. The odds of getting all the numbers right are absurdly low, which, paradoxically, is why Lotto revolutionized the industry. Before the game was introduced, state jackpots were relatively modest. Their size was limited by the number of players, since payouts reflected a percentage of ticket sales, as well as by state lottery commissions, which set a cap on the prize money. From 1964 to 1979, jackpots seldom exceeded $1 million. But Lotto was a rollover game. If a drawing was held and nobody won, a common occurrence given the odds, players could keep buying tickets. For those profiting from the lottery, this created a virtuous cycle. Every time the pot got bigger, more people were tempted to buy a ticket, and the more people bought tickets, the bigger the pot became. The whole thing was hugely counterintuitive. The worse the odds of winning became, the more people wanted to play. Alexander Hamilton was right. To the average person, the difference between 1 in 3 million odds and 1 in 300 million odds didn't matter. But the difference between a $3 million jackpot and a $300 million jackpot mattered enormously. Recognizing this, lottery commissions began lifting prize caps and adding more numbers, say 6 out of 50 instead of 5 out of 30, thus making the likelihood of winning even smaller. The New York Lotto launched in 1978 with 1 in 3.8 million odds. Today, the odds are 1 in 45 million of winning. Despite all this, and to the despair of statisticians everywhere, Lotto soon became the nation's most popular lottery game. But although ticket sales and prize winning soared, they did not do so equally across the country. Since rollover jackpots disproportionately benefited states with large populations and therefore more potential players, in response, smaller states banded together to form multi-state lotteries, a trend that culminated in Powerball and Mega Millions, each of which started as a collaboration among a handful of states, but is now played everywhere the lottery is legal. The resulting prizes are truly astronomical. This past July, two people who bought a lottery ticket in Illinois bucked 1 in 302 million odds to win a $1.34 billion Mega Millions jackpot. The irony, as Cohen notes, is that Americans' obsession with unimaginable wealth, including the dream of hitting a multi-million dollar lottery jackpot, corresponded to a decline in financial security for most working people. Beginning in the 1970s and accelerating into the 1980s, the income gap between the rich and the poor widened, job security and pensions eroded, health care costs and unemployment rose, and, for children born in those decades, our long-standing national promise that education and hard work would render them better off than their parents ceased to be true. Life, as it turned out, imitated the lottery. For most Americans, it was getting harder and harder to win. Now, the lottery was supposed to make all this better, not worse. Its advocates claim that by filling state coffers without increasing state taxes, it would keep money in the pockets of average citizens. But this premise, which led state after state to approve lotteries, was simply untrue. Evidence from the first legalized lotteries quickly put pay to the fantasy that they would provide sufficient incomes to fund much of the business of running a state. In New Jersey, where proponents had imagined proceeds on the order of hundreds of millions of dollars, the lottery brought in $33 million its first year, about 2% of the state's revenue. When figures like that proved typical of the era, legalization advocates, no longer able to sell the lottery as a statewide silver bullet, ginned up other strategies instead, often with the help of scientific games. Rather than argue that a lottery would float most of a state's budget, they began claiming that it would cover a single line item, invariably a government service that was popular and nonpartisan, most often education, but sometimes elder care or public parks or aid for veterans. One virtue of this narrower approach was that it made campaigning for legalization easy. A vote for the lottery was not a way of supporting gambling, but a way of supporting veterans. A vote against the lottery was a vote against education. These campaigns were extraordinarily effective, but, as with the earlier ones, fundamentally misleading. For one thing, they too wildly inflated the impact of lottery money on state finances. In California, where an SGI-backed lottery initiative passed after a high-profile campaign touted it as a boon for school children, the resulting revenue covered in the lottery's first year about 5% of the state education budget. As of this year, according to the California Department of Education, lottery income accounts for roughly 1% of all K-12 funding. But that was not the worst of it. Again and again, education and other line items that served to persuade people to pass lottery proposals did not actually get any additional funding. Instead, the revenue went into the state's general fund. After this happened in California, other states mandated the lottery money flow directly into specified programs. But, as is often the case, when one loophole closes, another one opens. In Illinois, Florida, and Virginia, among other states, the lottery revenue did indeed go to a designated education fund, whereupon legislatures offset those gains by reducing the money coming in from general appropriations. In the end, Cohen writes, the lottery supplanted rather than supplemented state spending on education. Today, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, lotteries bring in, on average, about 1% of state revenue per year. Like all money, it matters, but whatever difference it makes is offset by two problems. The first is that the lotteries have made it harder than ever to pass much-needed tax increases because, thanks to years of noisy campaigning followed by decades of heavy promotion, the public wrongly believes that schools and other vital services are lavishly supported by gambling funds. The second is that the money raised by lotteries comes largely from the people who can least afford to part with it. Every state lottery is regressive, meaning that it takes a disproportionate toll on low-income citizens. Rich people do play the lottery, of course, but they buy fewer tickets than the poor, and because of that, and because their purchases constitute a much smaller percentage of their income, playing the lottery has a far smaller impact on their pocketbooks. For example, according to the consumer financial company Bankrate, players making more than $50,000 per year spend, on average, 1% of their income on lottery tickets, while those making less than $30,000 a year spend 13%. That means someone making $27,000 loses some $3,500 to the lottery every year. To put that number in context, nearly 60% of Americans have less than $1,000 in wage savings. Defenders of the lottery sometimes cast it as a tax on the stupid, meaning either that players don't
understand how unlikely they are to win or that they enjoy the game anyway. This suggests that lottery spending is a wholly personal rather than a partly structural decision, but in reality it is responsive to economic fluctuation. As Cohen writes, lottery sales increase as incomes fall, unemployment grows, and property rates rise. In the final pages of For a Dollar and a Dream, Cohen, a fair and meticulous collector of data, finally puts his thumb on the scale. Considering the regressive nature of state lotteries, their predatory practices, their role in fostering gambling addictions, the way they discourage normal taxation, and their relatively modest financial contributions, he concludes that they should not exist in the modern United States. As he acknowledges, this advice is not likely to be taken anytime soon. No state has repealed its lottery in more than 125 years. Still, he argues, we should work toward common sense reforms, such as banning the sale of tickets online, capping the cost of scratch-off tickets and the size of lotto jackpots, and, perhaps most important, closing a loophole that leaves lotteries exempt from FTC regulation and thus free from the constraints of truth in advertising laws. What would happen if state lotteries waned in influence or vanished altogether? Cohen surely overreaches when he claims that, quote, without such a blinding beacon, more Americans might be willing to think critically about the economic forces that have degraded access to social mobility and have made it more difficult for people to attain financial security, end quote. But he is right that governments in a democratic society should be in the business of improving the odds, not rigging the game, and that there are far more equitable and effective ways for the state to use its mighty powers to improve life for its citizens. As the California Lottery put it in a 2013 advertising campaign, believe in something bigger. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Well, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.